For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show usually recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. I'm your host, Red Sale, talking to you from the broom cupboard.
I'm Robert Kirkwood, talking to you from a bit of a noisy bedroom today. But coming up on today's show,
author of the Roman mysteries, Caroline Lawrence, takes us on a new adventure to ancient Greece.
Author Tim Finch takes us into the world of Edvard Grenins in his novel Peace Talks.
And we've got more cabin fever fables from Saraband Books.
That's all coming up in today's Read On.
Caroline Lawrence is the award-winning author of The Roman Mysteries, which attracted a huge international following. Now she's back with a new series, The Time Travel Diaries, the second of which is out now. She joined me down the line to tell me more. Caroline, welcome to Read On.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So for those who haven't yet encountered the Time Travel Diaries, tell us a little bit about them.
I essentially write books because no one has invented a time machine. I want to go back to the past. And the closest we can get is through books. So I've written over 30 historical novels set in the ancient world, which I'm kind of obsessed with, ancient Greece and ancient Rome especially. But it wasn't until like 2 years ago that I finally thought, I'm going to bite the time travel bullet and actually write some books where a kid goes back to ancient times and I can describe the sights, but also the sounds and the smell and the touch and the taste of the ancient world.
And it really does flag up how different the ancient world was to our own. Alex is a contemporary boy from London.
That's right. My hero is Alex, who's a 12-year-old London schoolboy, and he does Latin club at lunch, and his father was Greek, so he speaks modern Greek as well as English. So for that reason, because he knows a bit of Latin and a bit of Greek, an eccentric bazillionaire sends him back to Roman London to find a blue-eyed girl with an ivory knife, whose bones we really did find in Southwark near Shakespeare's Globe from a Roman-level graveyard. And like me, the eccentric bazillionaire, whose name is Solomon Daisy, is a bit obsessed with her. So for various reasons, adults can't go back in time, but kids can. So he sends Alex back.
And in that first time travel diary, he has quite an adventure. It gets a bit gruesome in places, and he and his sidekick Dinu actually swear they are never ever going to time travel again.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I wrote the first book as a standalone. I thought, you know, I'll just write, they go back once and it's so awful. You might want to go to ancient Rome maybe, or Pompeii or Sorrento in Italy, but you would not want to go back to ancient Londinium. And in fact, the original title of the book was going to be Ways to Die in Londinium, because there's so many ways you can die. And then my publisher said, well, go on and write another one. And I'm okay, I'll write Ways to Die in Ancient Athens. But we decided not to go with that slightly disturbing title. But Alex and his sidekick Dinu get lured to go back to ancient Athens to find the wisest man who ever lived. And I don't know how many of your listeners might know who that is, but if you guessed Socrates, pat yourself on the back. He was an ancient Athenian philosopher, and he's famous for saying, I know nothing. That's what makes him wiser than everybody else, because everyone else thinks they know something, but he's the only one who knows that he knows nothing. He is therefore the wisest man in the world.
Now, ancient Athens is not a place that has been visited very often by children's authors in the past. Rome is a little bit more commonly visited. What was it about Athens that really attracted you to write about it?
That's a great question. The book that changed my life, be careful what you read, kids, a book could change your life, was called The Last of the Wine. And it was a book set in ancient Athens during the time of Socrates, Plato, Xenophon. And I read it when I was 18 and I got obsessed with ancient Greece. And I'd always liked the Greek gods, but that book was like a time machine. It transported me back. So I got obsessed with ancient Greece. I studied ancient Greek at university and they said, oh, you have to do Latin too, two dead languages. We call it classics. So I did, first I loved the Greeks more and then I discovered the Romans are even cooler. But this one, I kind of go back to my roots. I think Athens would have been an amazing place to go in the 5th century BC. That's about in the 400s BC. That's like 2,500 years ago. It was hardly bigger than a village, but it produced some of the greatest statesmen, architects, philosophers, playwrights that have ever lived. It was like this amazing golden age when all these amazing people lived. And of course, the most famous in my mind was Socrates. So I thought I'd go back and I wondered, would it be as grungy as Roman London, which I describe as having streets that are like mud studded with gravel and stuff like that. Of course, if you've been to Athens, you know, it's beautifully hot and bright blue skies. So I went to Athens again, I've been a few times and tried to imagine not just the sights, but the sounds and the smells of the ancient agora, the ancient marketplace. And in fact, there's this wonderful ancient account that says you can buy anything in the ancient agora. You can buy birds, you can buy fruit, you can buy a witness for your trial to testify on your behalf. So it was just a jumble of people and things. And you might have heard like the shouts of stall keepers, like you can still hear on some of the streets of London, and roving snack sellers who'd walk around with trays of bread. And you might hear the twittering of birds in the bird market, and you might hear the barking of dogs, and you might hear, here's a great sound of ancient Greece, which is the clink of a cowbell or a sheep bell, that each one had a different sound. So your shepherd, as he comes through ancient Athens, you'd hear the clink of his bells, and you might even hear the sound of a bull being sacrificed or the bleat of a goat before its throat is cut, because of course they sacrificed animals to their gods.
My children were huge fans of the Roman mysteries. And something that really struck me from one of the books was that you said that every story starts with an object for you. Was there a particular object that inspired this book?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, the Roman mysteries were inspired by both the archaeology, but also the primary sources, the things written by ancient Romans. And that's one of the best things about reading Greek and Latin is, yes, they're dead languages, but once you read them, you're in the head of someone who lived 2,000 years ago. And one of my characters, Lupus, the boy with no tongue, is inspired by a little two-line poem by a poet called Martial, who talks about an owner who cut out his slave's tongue so that he couldn't testify against him. And so I get ideas from the primary sources, from the artifacts. For this book, it wasn't so much artifacts, it was more the primary sources. It was reading Plato's dialogues, which did my head in, I have to say, because Plato's like one of the biggest brains, probably one of the biggest geniuses of humanity, along there with Shakespeare and Mozart. And he wrote about Socrates, who Socrates himself, the wisest man who ever lived, never wrote a word, as far as we know. Maybe he wrote one little line of poetry, but it was mainly down to his disciple, his student Plato, who made him famous. And he discusses how a person should live in the world and what a good life is. And so Socrates was really the spur for my curiosity. And he was famously ugly. He had a snub nose and big fat lips and bug eyes, and he was bald. And people likened him to a satyr. If you know about Greek mythology, those are those creatures with goat ears and goat legs, and they drink wine a lot. And I had a revelation that Socrates would have looked a bit like Santa Claus in a tablecloth. If you could imagine Santa Claus, if he'd been working out on the beach for about 2 years and he was all brown and tanned and muscular, and then put him in a tablecloth with a walking stick, that's what Socrates would have looked like. So Socrates was my inspiration. I wanted to know why people have been writing about him for 2,000 years and try to get a grip on who he was.
And I know that you have had fan letters from children around the world who have been inspired to study Latin, having read your Roman mysteries. Are you hoping to inspire a similar renewal of worldwide interest in ancient Greece?
Absolutely, yeah, because it is so much fun to read dead languages, because like I said, it's like a giant code or puzzle, and reading ancient Greek, you can really impress your friends at a party. You can, for example, quote the beginning of Homer's Iliad about the anger of Achilles, menae de thea pelea de Achilleos ou lomenein, and people will be very impressed if you can quote some ancient Greek. And also, it's a different alphabet, and it looks really cool. It's alpha, beta, gamma. And when you first look at it, it looks like little black worms crawling on white. But then when you can read it, you actually can see pictures, and you can actually hear it being read. And if you know modern Greek, if you can understand modern Greek, you might understand a bit of ancient Greek as well. So yeah, I love dead languages. I also do Hebrew as well. So I can do Hebrew, Latin, and Greek, and they take me back to the past.
Those are the differences. But I think one of the things that has really struck me is just how little human beings have changed.
This is probably the most compelling aspect of the study of classics, the ancient world, is how much like us they were, even though they lived so long ago. And you'll be reading along or something or listening to something being read and think, yeah, they were like us. Yeah, they were like us. And then suddenly, bam, something hits you and you think, no, they weren't like us. And so it's this tension of how they were like us. Of course, everyone wants to be fed and clothed and have a comfortable, happy life. But this is, again, what Socrates talks about, is what is a good life? And way back then, everyone thought money and fame was the best thing. And Socrates says, no, the most important thing in life, spoiler alert, is curating, taking care of your soul, the eternal part of you, and doing what's right. And this is amazing because he lived like 500 years before Jesus Christ, who has many of the same ideas. It's fascinating, that tension. And that's why I've been studying classics for 40 years and will never get bored or tired of it, because it throws a light on our own world.
Now, much of Greek storytelling was in the oral tradition, and it's something that strikes me very much as I listen to audiobooks for my stories, that oral tradition continues 2,500 years later. And I know many of your books have been made into audiobooks.
Yeah, and I love audiobooks. In fact, although I can read the Iliad in Greek, I love to hear it being read, because as you say, that's the way it started. It was a bard, a storyteller, telling a story after dinner, maybe plucking a stringed instrument in between a little bit. But that ability to hear the story, hear the words come in and make the smells and the sounds and the images in your head. So I love listening to audiobooks, and I love listening to my own audiobooks. In fact, they've done the first one, the first time travel diaries, read by Simon Skardefeld. And I've just been walking around listening to it, and I really enjoy it. I think, did I write that? Yeah, that's quite good. I like that. So yeah, audiobooks are fantastic. And I'm really so happy that they're going to be doing a version of Adventure in Athens. And I'll have to coach Simon Skardefeld a little bit, because there's some Greek phrases like ouden oida, which means I know nothing.
While we wait for Simon to be able to return to a studio, you've very kindly offered to read an extract exclusively for the Read On listeners.
Exclusively for you. And as I said earlier, the reason I want to go back in time is the sight, the sound, the smell, the taste, all that sensory stuff. So when Alex gets to Athens, he's trying to find Socrates, who's supposed to be speaking in the Agora, the ancient market. And I have a chapter called Smelly Agora. And I'll just read you a little bit. And as I read it, see if you can imagine the smells that Alex would smell. Maybe it was because the blazing sun magnified all the odors, but the moment we entered the agora, I encountered a symphony of smells. The sickly sweet whiff of sewage, from the drain behind us formed a bass note. Next came the rhythmic pong of sausage sellers roasting their ancient hot dogs on portable clay barbecues. Then the churchy melody of incense drifting from shrines under their sacred trees. Rising above it all was a chorus of smells coming from the men around us. Rank sweat, stale urine, bad breath, and perfumed beard oil.
Fantastic.
So I love the idea that smells can actually be like a symphony of sounds, because you're getting a kind of synesthesia, which is when you confuse the senses a little bit. And you can see the notes as different colors, and you can smell the sounds and hear the smells. And as I said, it's the closest thing to going back in a time machine. And it's much safer than going back in a time machine, too.
And while we're all stuck at home, have you been able to start work on the third book in the series?
Yeah, I am. In the Time Travel Diaries to Athens, they go back when Socrates is in his like 40s, and they meet this like 9-year-old kid who likes to pick his nose, and they discover he's Plato, but he's kid Plato. So he's like gonna grow up to be a genius, but at the moment he's got his finger up his nose half the time. And that gave me the idea, what if you could go back and meet kid Jesus, or maybe teen Jesus? Like, what would Jesus have been like when he was an adolescent? You know, would he have been grumpy and moody? So because I speak Hebrew as well as Greek and Latin, I thought, let's go to ancient Israel for our final trip, maybe. And he can see if he can find Jesus Christ when he was a kid. Of course, his name would have been Yeshua, which is the Aramaic for Jesus. And that can be really fun because ancient Israel doesn't just have Hebrew, but it has the Roman soldiers who speak Latin, and then Greek culture. So Greek was the lingua franca in the first century AD. So you'd have all my languages, and I'm having so much fun researching that book.
Well, Caroline Lawrence, thank you so much for taking us back to ancient Greece for a few minutes. I know lots of people are going to enjoy Adventure in Athens, and I hope you'll come back to tell us about teenage Jesus.
Thank you, Red, and stay safe.
And you. Adventure in Athens, the second of the Time Travel Diaries by Caroline Lawrence, is out now in print, with that audiobook on its way soon. And in the meantime, you can find a wide selection of her Roman mysteries in the RNIB library in a full range of accessible formats. And Caroline will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
During this coronavirus crisis, RNIB's helpline is incredibly busy. People with sight loss are struggling with food shopping, loneliness, getting accessible information, and much more. For many, the helpline is also a lifeline, and that's why every call needs to be answered. If you feel able to, please consider donating to RNIB's appeal today to help everyone stay safe and connected. Just text CONNECT to 70688 to donate £10 now. Thank you.
The current times can be especially challenging for people with sight loss. For dedicated advice, support, or to access our free talking books and reading services, call RNIB's helpline on 0303 123 9999. Open 8 to 8 weekdays and 9 to 5 on Saturdays. Standing with you through every challenge. RNIB. See differently.
Tim Finch is an author and journalist whose latest novel, Peace Talks, has just been simultaneously published in hardback and audio. In it, he examines the history of a long relationship against the backdrop of international peace negotiations. Tim joined me over Zoom to tell me more.
Hi.
So, for those who haven't yet read Peace Talks, can you give us the blurb?
Well, the basic idea is that there's this fellow called Edward Berens, who's half Norwegian, half English, and he conducts peace talks. And he is in the Austrian Tyrol with two warring parties trying to bring a conflict to an end. And we follow him through that, and we realise that he's sort of talking about what's happening during his days at these negotiations, with someone who's absent, and that's his wife. And it turns out in the end that his wife is no longer alive, and but he's speaking to her as though she's still with him, which she, in a sense, very strongly is. And then, as it were, the major reveal in the book is what happened to his wife, how it was that she died. And then, without giving too much away, the idea behind the book in my own head was that we're always trying to reach a place of some peace and resolution in our own lives. And that's a struggle, and there's difficulties, and there's flare-ups, and there's passages where life is a bit more straightforward and simple, but then there are moments of great drama. But in the end, we never reach a total situation of peace. Peace is sort of patched up. It's put together as best it can. And so I suppose it's quite a sad book, I must say. It's quite a sort of elegiac book.
The peace negotiations that are going on are between an unnamed country and insurgents who are trying to overthrow the regime. And it's a novel approach to have that as the backdrop to examine the tensions within a relationship.
Yes, I suppose so. I mean, I don't want to make too much of the fact that a relationship between two loving individuals is equivalent to two warring parties in a civil war. There's not a direct parallel I'm trying to draw between the two things. In a sense, he takes comfort in these imagined conversations with his wife from the horrors of the world which he faces, which he has to face full on because he's involved daily in negotiating around the most grotesque atrocities, not least. The backdrop of the idea was, how do we find peace in the world? And we find peace in the world through conversation, through dialogue, through reconciliation, and to a certain extent, in just being able to accept the world as it is. And there is a sense in which, by the end, in a way which is far from satisfactory, because his wife remains dead at the end of the book, but he has come to some sort of resolution with the world as it is. And it seems to me as though the conduct of conflicts is often a bit like that. It's very rare, even when a conflict comes to an end and the peace talks have succeeded, that the situation thereafter in the country or countries involved is one of perfect peace. It's the best you have. And so in a sense, the book's exploring the fact that life is in many ways very, very unsatisfactory, and you get your pleasures and your moments of light where you can.
And that's particularly resonant at the moment, as we are removed from a lot of human interaction and maybe have more time on our hands to consider how we interact with other people.
Yes, obviously, any novel is written years before it gets published, or at least started years before it gets published. And so, you know, there is absolutely nothing in my mind when I was writing this book that pertains to this weird situation we're in now. But it's uncanny the way in which themes can emerge that seem relevant to the times now. So anybody who listening to this, who went away and said, I'd read that, would pick up various things, I think. In effect, Edvard and his negotiating team and the two parties to the conflict are in a sort of quarantine situation. They're in isolation up in the mountains. I draw allusions between them being in the mountains in Austria with the sanatorium in Thomas Mann's famous novel Magic Mountain, which is referenced at various times. And so they are, as it were, locked away, away from the world. So there's that parallel for a start. And then there is this sense, which I think people will be having, of communicating somehow, but not directly, with loved ones who are not with them at the time. Not necessarily or hopefully actually dead, but you know, we're all in a situation now where people who are very close to us, loved ones and dear friends, are absent. So we have things like the thing I'm talking to you on now in order to directly communicate. But there's also a strong sense in which we are all thrown back on our own resources. And then I guess the other theme that there's a parallel between the book and what's happening now is that Edvard, for all that he is active in the world and he's engaged in some of the most important activities you could possibly have, which is trying to resolve conflicts, he's nonetheless a deeply lonely man. And the book is a lot about loneliness and grief and bereavement and how to come to terms with that. And it makes the point, I hope poignantly, that it doesn't really help to have lots of activity and to be around lots of people, including important people, if you're missing the person that you most want to be with. And he is throughout the book.
Now, you yourself have worked as a journalist for many years. I wondered if some of that sense of having to take an objective view fed into Edvard.
I was a BBC journalist for a number of years, but I was one of the ones who sort of ran away from the sound of gunfire. I was never heroic enough to go to anywhere remotely dangerous. I worked very largely during my career for the BBC at Westminster, which, although a place of a great deal of conflict in some ways, and obviously at the centre of events, is fairly safe from the point of view of not putting yourself in any danger. But the question still is relevant, I think, because it is the case that you observe how people who have important jobs with lots of responsibility and are involved in the world a great deal are nonetheless sometimes quite lonely, poor communicators, don't have great relationships with other people. And I was drawing on a bit of that, I think. And obviously, in any peace negotiations, there's a lot of politics, a lot of silly politics, actually. I mean, I hope I have some fun with some of the absurdities of any political negotiations and the way relationships, you know, highly important things are reduced to tiny petty points. I've stressed how the book is, on the whole, a serious and sad book. Nonetheless, there are a lot of moments of humour and absurdity, and they come from the elements where, which I've imagined, I have to say, I've never worked in peace negotiations or even been that close to them. But I do know people who have been, particularly around the Northern Ireland conflict, for instance. I've got an old friend who was close to all of the Good Friday Agreement discussions, for instance. And he could be quite hilarious about, in the midst of them trying to resolve this dreadful conflict, which had torn apart Northern Ireland for more than 20 years, really silly, stupid little tiny things would derail the talks for days and hours. And so I tried to draw some of that into the book as well.
And did you find yourself casting your eye back to any predecessors who'd worked in journalism to become authors, such as Evelyn Waugh or Graham Greene, when writing the book?
Any writer is writing in the shadow of all the writers who came before. And obviously, particularly the great writers, the writers of the canon in some sense. And so, you know, of course, I have read lots of Graham Greene and Evelyn Waugh and Hemingway and people like that. So they're in there in the mix of what I understand writing to be about. And I guess in the sense that this is a book which mixes the sort of political with the personal, there are some parallels between the two writers you named in some of their writing. I think perhaps particularly Greene, because Greene obviously in a number of his more serious novels at least really grapples with these issues of guilt and responsibility and death and mortality and all those sorts of things. I'm making it sound a bit heavier than it is, and there are elements. The war parallel perhaps might be that the book at times has some sort of comic set pieces, which I hadn't thought of before, but now you mention it, might have some resonances there. And as I say, I had in my mind a little bit the slightly sort of narcotic, lethargic atmosphere that goes with Mann's Magic Mountain. That's alluded to a few times. So like any book, you can see allusions and references there if you've read these previous writers. But if you haven't read anything by any of those other people, I think you could read this book fairly straightforwardly. It's not a book that wears its literary allusions that heavily, I don't think.
And is there a freedom in writing fiction that you don't have in being a journalist?
Oh, definitely. And I'm a late starter in writing, or at least being published. But, you know, one of the reasons I've always wanted to do it is that I'm sort of more interested in the questions that come through exploring your own imagination and your own mind than I am in the world as it actually is. I don't do much research for my novels. I draw obviously on my own experiences to some extent. And I've got, you know, everything that I've ever read and heard about and seen on the television and the radio to draw on, but I don't do a huge amount of research on something because I'm not really sure that that's what novels are for. If someone was to say to me, that isn't how peace talks are negotiated, or you got that thing wrong, I'd just go, well, that doesn't really matter. It isn't important to me, particularly that the absolute details are right. It's an imagined set of peace talks. It is not designed to just say, this is what peace talks are really like.
Now, the book has been made into a rather fine audiobook by Richard Trinder. Did you have anything to do with his selection to read the book?
Only in the sense that the publishers very generously said, we're thinking of using Richard Trinder to record the book. Do you have any objection? And of course, I didn't. I mean, he's an actor of great pedigree and They sent me some examples of him doing audiobooks in the past, and they hired someone very good. I have to say, I hadn't heard the book, and I actually quite liked it. Someone the other day was saying to me, have you read the book recently? And of course I haven't. It's, you know, actually ages since I sat down and went through it. You know, more recently did copy editing and what have you, but that's a grueling and horrible way of reading any book, never mind your own. So in a strange way, you know, in this situation where you talk about the book, it's sometime afterwards, and sometimes I even struggle to remember little things. People tell me things and I can't remember them. But I would actually like to hear the audio version just to sort of see what he's made of it. So someone said to me at the weekend, are you going to do that? And I said I was going to. And now you've mentioned it, I think I'll listen to it as well. Not all of it, I hasten to add, because this book obviously is sort of imprinted on my mind, really. But I'd like to hear how it's done.
Well, I think you're in for a treat. Generally, are you a fan of audiobooks?
I have to say I'm not, no. And I don't mean that in the sense that I have any objection to them, but I'm a sighted person and I can read books in the sort of most traditional way. I mean, I don't read them on Kindles either. I read actual physical books, and I've always liked reading actual physical books. And I have barely ever consumed a book via the audio version. Once or twice when travelling abroad many years ago, more with sort of cassette tape type things, I've done it. But no, it's not the way I generally do it.
Well, Tim Finch, thank you so much for introducing us to the book and for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you.
Peace Talks by Tim Finch is out now in hardback and audio, which is narrated by Richard Trinder.
Saraband Books are an independent publisher in Scotland. And during this time of social distancing and self-isolation, they say that cabin fever is real. But Saraband don't want anyone to feel scared or alone, so they started a podcast. A place to share stories, spread calm, and have a laugh.
Hello, and welcome to Cabin Fever Fables. I'm Sarah Hunt from indie publisher Saraband, and this is episode 5. Each day, we're challenging an author to read an extract from their book that is, in some way, relevant to an aspect of coronavirus and lockdown, whether it's on isolation, feeling unwell, mental health, or anything the author wants to relate to their experience. We're doing this to provide a bit of an escape, a brief distraction from the anxiety and stress, if we possibly can. So, we're keeping the tone positive, hopeful or informative, or all of the above. Today, we're introducing a guest whose novel follows two women in their early 20s, who've encountered each other through a facial recognition app. It's a thriller, but one character in particular is struggling with her mental health, something that's struck a chord with many of the Generation Z readers who have mentioned the book on their social media. That's Gen Z to our new American listeners. Hello. People of this age often live in small, cramped spaces too. So self-isolation is considerably more challenging for them than for, say, empty nesters with big houses, spare rooms and a garden to escape to. That's without even considering whether they've developed the resilience to cope with being cooped up in a small, shared space, or else being alone with nothing but their social media for company. Here is Nicola Martin to tell you about it.
My debut novel is called Dead Ringer. It's a psychological thriller about what it's like to meet your doppelganger. The two main characters are strangers called Ella and Jem, who come from completely different walks of life, have nothing in common, but they happen to look uncannily alike. Ella is shy, reserved. She comes from a little place in Cumbria called Warney Island, whereas her doppelganger, Jem, is an outrageous London party girl. However, they're both harbouring big secrets, which will inevitably come to light when their lives collide. One of the big themes of the novel is loneliness. This is what happens when Jem, our outrageous party girl, unexpectedly arrives on the doorstep of Ella on Warney Island. From a distance, with her unkempt hair, her strange outfit, and her swaying gait, Jem looked like a stranger. But when she turned her face toward me, I felt a jolt. How could someone who looked so much like me be so completely different? It was a question that had bugged me for weeks. I'd gone to London hoping to find a kindred spirit, a twin, someone who got me, automatically, the way family was supposed to. Instead, I'd found Jem. Hey, what's up, Twinny? Nothing. What are you doing here? Jem flung herself upon me in a hug that felt like a performance. I'm on a little holiday from myself, she said, pulling away at once, exploring the outer reaches of nowhere and nothing. I bristled. Right. What was that supposed to mean? The silence between us stretched. Jem's smile slid off her face. She made an exaggerated shivering motion. Fancy making me a cup of tea? She said. You do have a house, right? You northerners don't just live in the wild. My jaw seized. Who the hell do you think you are? Maybe you should go back to London, I said. You're not even going to make me a cup of tea? She asked. There was a pitiful note in her voice. Now that her Cheshire Cat grin had vanished, I noticed how pale she looked. Her shoulders drooped and a hand lay across her ribs, as if protecting herself. Though she was fully made up, with bright red lips, her eyeliner was smudged. It accentuated the shadows under her eyes. She was skinnier than she'd been a month ago. Her weight was closer to my own. Her tiredness, too, made the resemblance between us even more uncanny. However, as we stepped inside, any pity I'd felt for my double drained away. Her lip curled, her eyebrows rose. In her presence, I was hyper-aware of the dingy floral curtains at the windows, the curled edges of the lino. I tried to personalise the space with a faded poster of the Paris skyline, but even that now seemed pathetic. My home wasn't a multi-million pound apartment. It wasn't even a modest house. It was a caravan. This is where you live? I jerked my head in a nod. No, this is a hilarious joke. My mansion's round the corner. Oh, wow. Cozy. I filled the kettle, flexing my fingers to stop them from trembling. Jem was roaming the enclosed space like an appraiser at an estate sale. Picking up a book, she flicked through it at speed. Then she moved on to my guitar and strummed a single note. I sloshed milk into two mugs and resisted the urge to slap her hands. You have a brother, right? Jem asked. I didn't reply. Jem paused to shake my old ceramic piggy bank. Empty. Where does he live? I scrunched up my face, anticipating my double's ridicule. Here, I said. My parents run the caravan park. Ah. Oh. She swept a hand through the air. A family affair. What's your surname? Moser, right? The kettle was boiling, its high whistle making my scalp prickle. Moser, I said. Why? Jem shrugged. She strayed to the compact bathroom area and began scrutinising herself in the small mirror mounted above the basin. Got any eye makeup remover? She asked. It was such a non sequitur, I didn't know how to react. No. No probs. She plucked a little pot of Vaseline that I used as lip balm off the edge of the basin and smeared a blob of it across her eyelid. Then she grabbed a tissue from the box and used it to wipe the Vaseline away, removing her eyeliner at the same time. With another swipe, she got rid of her red lipstick. I'll probably have to teach you to put on eyeliner, she said. Otherwise you'll look like someone attacked your eye with a crayon. It can be tricky for beginners. What? You normally wear your hair tied back, right? She grabbed my hairbrush and pulled it through her tangled hair. This at last spurred me into action. Forgetting the tea mugs, I crossed the small space and snatched the hairbrush out of her hands. My double apparently didn't notice my appalled expression. She was done with the hairbrush already. Sweeping her hair back, she secured it with one of my hairbands. "Ponytail today," she said. "That's easy." She turned to face me, putting her hands on her hips. Even though she still wore her own eclectic collection of mismatched clothes, she had, in less than a minute, transformed herself. She transformed herself into me. "I'm Ella," she said. "I'm a northerner, but I don't live in the wild." "Don't," I said, my voice rising. "Don't make fun of me." "I'm not." Jem actually seemed affronted. "I'm just practicing. You should practice too. Start getting into character." "What?" The worst part was that my double looked perfectly at home in my life. Her shoulders were relaxed, her foot tapping an idle beat. Me, I wanted to scream. "Don't you ever get bored of yourself?" Jem asked. "Don't you ever get so bored you want to climb out of your own skull and be someone else for a while?" I stared back at her. "Don't you ever feel that way?" she asked. Jem was a lunatic. No doubt about that. I wanted to disagree with her. I wanted to yell at her to get out. Instead, I found myself giving the slightest of nods.
Thanks, Nicola. There's quite a bit to think about there. Dead Ringer explores the North-South divide and how this affects life chances. Who could have predicted that the current situation means people are desperately trying to leave London and head for the hills? "Go back to London," Ella says. That has a whole new meaning now that people are spreading the virus into the countryside and overwhelming local health services. But I do think there'll be plenty of people wishing they could do what Jem just said she's up to. She said she wants to take a holiday from myself. Well, let's move on to our four corona questions for Nicola. You're in isolation. You're at home. What are you reading to pass the time?
I'm sure other people know the feeling of having that itchy kind of feeling where you can't quite decide what to read. You really want to read, but you just can't figure out what the perfect book to be reading is. I had that the other day, and I managed to scroll all the way through my Kindle alphabetically until I got to the letter V. And I stumbled across a Philippa Gregory novel that I downloaded months ago. It's called The Virgin's Lover, and it's about Queen Elizabeth I. And I thought, yes, that's what I want. I want to lose myself in the past. And so, yeah, I've been finding a lot of solace from historical fiction and also historical non-fiction, because what I'm listening to on audio is a Virginia Nicholson book called Millions Like Us, which is about women during World War II. And similarly, there's something very inspiring, very comforting about dipping into the past when people felt that they were facing insurmountable obstacles. And they got through them. They kept calm and carried on. And so, yeah, the past is my escapism at the moment.
What are you cooking tonight? I'm assuming it's probably something from your store cupboard.
Well, I'm going to use up all of my chickpeas, which have somehow become like gold recently. You can't buy a chickpea around here, but I've still got some. So I'm going to make a chickpea curry. I tend to cook in batches. So I will make myself a great big vat of chickpea curry and freeze some of it for later on. You basically just throw in all the garlic that you have to hand, a whole bunch of onions, tons of spices, whatever veggies you have lying around, and of course some lovely coconut milk, and you get a lovely warming curry. So that's what I will be looking forward to.
Who would you choose to dine with tonight if we were not all self-isolating?
Well, is it just me, or is anyone else having the same conversation over and over again with everyone in their lives? Where it's all about, oh, well, I couldn't find such and such at the supermarket. Oh, I managed to find such and such at the supermarket. I've already done it myself with the chickpeas. But yeah, I think rather than pick a great conversationalist, I would invite to dinner a couple of my favourite musicians, because music is always my comfort. You don't have to talk, you can just listen to someone playing an amazing song. So I would pick Josh Ritter and Chris Thiele, who are two of my favourite folk musicians. And I think we'd have a rollicking good time filled with music and storytelling, and hopefully not too much of the real world.
What's the most idiotic or funny or noteworthy bit of corona advice or official tip or corona behaviour that you've seen today?
It's hard to beat the piece of 100% genuinely given advice I received from my sister. And the good news is she's got the cure for coronavirus. It's all about the nose, and you need to get some salt water and spritz it at your nasal cavities. And then you need to keep that salt water very hot. You need to keep your nose hot. So you grab your hairdryer and aim it at your nose for quite a long time. I think at least 20 minutes. And then you'll be fine. And to put this in context, the only hairdryer I have is one from when I was a child. And it's a Snoopy hairdryer. So I will be ready with my Snoopy hairdryer and aiming him at my nostrils so that I'm absolutely fine. From my sister to you all, that is my advice. Grab your hairdryer.
What a lot of utter rubbish there is flying about masquerading as corona facts. It's never been more important to go only to good trusted sources for information. Fact-checked, professional journalism from places like the BBC, The Guardian, The Times and The New York Times are all good examples. We're also getting good communiques directly from the NHS. Remember to take that dead cert remedy with a pinch of salt. See what I did there with the salt? That's all for today. If you want to join in Cabin Fever Fables with stories or comments, or read Aisling's Corona Bulletin with resources and information, you can find us on Twitter, at Saraband Books.
Thanks very much to Sarah at Saraband Books. Their web address is saraband.net. That's S-A-R-A-B-A-N-D. And they're on Twitter, at Saraband Books.
Now it's back to Caroline Lawrence for the books of her life. Caroline, was there a book that you read that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
I could talk about this for about 24 hours, but I think the first book I ever remember loving was The Cat in the Hat. It's just such a great story about this subversive cat in the hat who arrives in a house where the kids are being really good, and the goldfish says, "Don't let him get away with all that mischief." And it's by Dr. Seuss. And it was in rhyme, and I loved that book. So I would say The Cat in the Hat was maybe my first book that I really, really loved when I was little.
The sun did not shine, it was too wet to play, so we sat in the house all that cold, cold, wet day. I sat there with Sally, we sat there, we two, and I said, "How I wish we had something to do! Too wet to go out, and too cold to play ball, so we sat in the house, we did nothing at all. So all we could do was to sit, 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 sit. And we did not like it not one little bit. And then something went bump. How that bump made us jump. We looked. Then we saw him step in on the mat. We looked and we saw him. The Cat in the Hat. And he said to us,
Why do you sit there like that? I know it is wet and the sun is not sunny, but we can have lots of good fun that is funny. I know some good games we could play, said the cat. I know some new tricks, said the cat in the hat. A lot of good tricks. I will show them to you. Your mother will not mind at all if I do.
The late Stephen Thorne narrating The Cat in the Hat from The Best of Dr. Seuss, which is TB11567. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yes, there is. It's my comfort book. When I'm poorly or on a rainy day, I open up My Family and Other Animals by Gerald Durrell, set in Corfu, the sun-soaked Greek island in the 1930s. It makes me laugh. It transports me to a sun-soaked Greek island. It is my comfort book, and I love it to bits, and it's suitable for all ages.
As you know, here in Corfu, nothing is ever done the correct way. Everyone starts out with the best intentions, but something always seems to go wrong. When the Greek king visited the island some years ago, the climax of his tour was to be a sort of stage show, a play. The climax of the drama was the Battle of Thermopylae, and as the curtain fell, the Greek army was supposed to drive the Persian army triumphantly into the wings. Well, it appears that the people playing the part of the Persians were a bit disgruntled at the thought of having to retreat in front of the king, and the fact that they had to play the part of Persians also, rankled. It only required a little incident to set things off. Unfortunately, during the battle scene, the leader of the Greek army misjudged the distance and caught the leader of the Persian army quite a heavy blow with his wooden sword. This, of course, was an accident. I mean to say, the poor fellow didn't mean to do it. But nevertheless, it was sufficient to inflame the Persian army to such an extent that instead of retreating, they advanced. The center of the stage became a milling mob of helmeted soldiers locked in mortal combat. Two of them were thrown into the orchestra pit before someone had the sense to lower the curtain. The king remarked later that he had been greatly impressed by the realism shown in the battle scene. The burst of laughter sent the pale geckos scuttling up the wall in alarm. Theodore, Larry laughed mockingly, I'm sure you made that up. No, no, Theodore would protest. It's quite true. I saw it myself. It sounds the most unlikely story. Here in Corfu, said Theodore, his eyes twinkling with pride, anything can happen.
Nigel Davenport, narrating My Family and Other Animals by Gerald Durrell, which is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB library. Finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Well, actually, there is a book that I think all adults and kids would like, and it's by Anne Rice, who writes those vampire books, but this is called Christ the King Out of Egypt. I've read a few books about what Jesus might have been like as a kid. This is Jesus as a 7-year-old, and she gets it absolutely right. She gets all the details of Alexandria and ancient Palestine and Jerusalem and Nazareth and the Jewish ceremonies. So I highly recommend Christ the Lord Out of Egypt by Anne Rice. And it's sadly not on audiobook, which is really frustrating. So because the book I just recommended isn't available as an audiobook, I'm going to urge you to listen to my favorite audiobook ever, which is True Grit, read by Donna Tartt. Now, Donna Tartt is an author in her own right, but she's the best reader that I've ever heard. And True Grit, again, is a book for anyone aged 8 to 80, you will adore it. And it's just, she reads it so brilliantly. So True Grit, they made two movies out of it, but neither movie is as good as the book. I highly recommend it.
That night, Tom Chaney went to a bar room and got into a game of cards with some riffraff like himself and lost his wages. He did not take the loss like a man, but went back to the room at the boarding house and sulled up like a possum. He had a bottle of whiskey, and he drank that. Papa was sitting in the parlor, talking to some drummers. By and by, Chaney came out of the bedroom with his rifle. He said he had been cheated and was going back to the bar room and get his money. Papa said that if he had been cheated, then they'd best go talk to the law about it. Chaney would not listen. Papa followed him outside and told him to surrender the rifle, as he was in no fit state to start a quarrel with a gun in his hand. My father was not armed at that time. Tom Chaney raised his rifle and shot him in the forehead, killing him instantly. There was no more provocation than that, and I tell it as it was told to me by the High Sheriff of Sebastian County. Some people might say, "Well, what business was it of Frank Ross to meddle?" My answer is this. He was trying to do that short devil a good turn. Chaney was a tenant, and Papa felt responsibility. He was his brother's keeper. Does that answer your question?
Donna Tartt narrating True Grit, which is available commercially. Caroline Lawrence, thank you so much for sharing your passion for reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you. And if any of your readers would like to get in touch with me, I love feedback. I love to hear from you. You can either email me through my website, carolinelawrence.com, or you can tweet me at Caroline Lawrence, no E at the end, and I'd love to hear from you.
And that's Lawrence with a W.
Lawrence, like Lawrence of Arabia, with a W.
If you want to share the books of your life or ask us about anything that you've heard on Read On, the email address is radio@rnib.org.uk.
Alas, that's all we've got time for this week.
But we'll be back at the same time next week, or you can always download us as a podcast.
Just search for RNIB Audiobook Show Read On in your favourite podcast app. And if you can, rate, review, please leave us 5 stars or a nice kind word.
You can also follow us on Twitter. I'm at RedSail, which is RedSzell.
And I'm at talking_books.
Farewell until next week. Stay well, and don't forget to read on.